Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. We also welcome our online and radio listeners, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker this evening, Edward Warner, first had a distinguished career as an exploration geologist. He has lectured on geology and cooperative conservation at numerous universities. Since leaving the natural gas business in the year 2000, he has pursued philanthropy full-time. As he will tell us in more detail, fewer than 5,000 black rhinos remain in the wilds of sub-Saharan Africa. Few, if any, laymen like Dr. Warner have been invited to care for them in the wild, some of the most dangerous volunteer fieldwork around, in support of the International Rhino Foundation's Rhino Conservancy Project. He certainly had some adventures, and they gave him the opportunity to develop the philosophy he calls radical conservationism. It includes partnerships between local communities and private landowners in Africa. Following our program, Dr. Warner will sign copies of his book, Running with Rhinos, just published in March. Proceeds go toward wildlife conservation. By the way, the book includes some good photos. Now, please help me welcome Edward Warner, radical conservationist.
Thank you, Norma. Carry-on luggage. I hope he deflates after this talk. Following my career in oil and gas, and having been exposed to a certain amount of demonization because I was a geologist developing oil and gas resources, a demonization by the old environmental movement, I realized that there was a huge amount of work that could be done positively in environment and conservation if we stopped litigating, regulating, and harming people's livelihoods. One of the things that happened in the U.S. environmental movement was that we could afford to make a lot of mistakes. We could afford to destroy a lot of wealth. We could afford to punish a lot of people, and that's because we are rich. I went to Africa not to tell Africans how to work, how to conserve wildlife, how to maintain these, what I call the great Pleistocene megafauna, the only one left on Earth, that in Africa. I went to learn from them. If you think about this, we can afford to make a lot of mistakes, and yet we can get it right. And we have. We've gotten a lot of things right in this country. They couldn't afford that in Africa. In the third world, people are poor. You spend a lot of money and you make a lot of mistakes and you get nowhere. And you leave people damaged and impoverished. In the old Rhodesian colonies, some very remarkable things happened. And so I would like to take you back to 1975 and compare and contrast what was going on in wildlife management in the U.S. versus what happened in the old Rhodesian colony of the Ian Smith minority government, something that we have criticized tremendously, and rightfully so for some of its policies. But in this case, something really quite remarkable happened in Africa. So in America, we develop what's called the North American model of wildlife management, and that is where states control wildlife. States own the wildlife, and the game and fish or natural resources or wildlife agencies developed a program whereby they could actually use trophy hunting and fishing as the fuel for funding wildlife conservation. So in most states in the United States, they don't dip into taxpayer money. They use hunting licenses, fishing licenses, and a variety of techniques to raise money, which funds their agencies. And they're very proud of this, and rightfully so. But around 1975, a funny thing happened on the way to the circus. We became very interested in a larger biology. The environmental movement realized that a few animals were not important. Biodiversity was important. Large landscapes were important. Single species that were being threatened and disappearing were important. This entire movement put tremendous pressure on game and fish departments. All of a sudden, they were responsible for obligate species that had no financial production for them. All of a sudden, there were bird species that birders weren't even hardly looking at, and there were all kinds of species, large and small, that were going to cost the natural resources and game and fish agencies a lot of money, and they had no way to raise a lot more money. The only way they did it, which was actually quite clever, was to start to auction off, create a market-based economy for some of their better wildlife. So typically, let's say you wanted to hunt a desert bighorn sheep, a very rare animal. If you went into the lottery, you might get a hunting permit for that once in your lifetime. You may never even see an animal during your hunt. But that's the chance that you took, right? And the game and fish agencies, especially in the West, realized that, wow, why don't we go to the big safari and hunting conventions and we'll auction these off? And they auctioned them out for a lot of money. And that created millions and millions of dollars for wildlife conservation, not just for desert bighorn sheep or elk or animals or, you know, mule deer, but it created a lot of money for alternative conservation approaches. So that was about as far as they took it. Well, in the Ian Smith minority government in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe in 1973, they announced that they owned the wildlife. And a large wildlife industry had already developed. Live sales of animals, meat production, trophy hunting, and photo safari business. All of those things were alive and well in that area. And the people working in that industry went and sued the government, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court of Rhodesia, Zimbabwe said something utterly incredible. They said, before this government and for the years and years of colonial and pre-colonial life, nobody owned the wildlife. And they referred back to Roman law, res nullius, nobody owns the wildlife. So the Roman Empire did not have a king. So the king in England owned the wildlife. And if you poached a deer, you either were hung or transported to Australia, which was actually good for Australia, you know, because these people who actually wanted to make a living and actually not starve to death, so they had some spirit in them. You know, but the king owned the wildlife. Well, in the Roman Empire, nobody owned the wildlife. Wildlife was a resource to be utilized. And so what happened in Zimbabwe, even after the Bush War and the rise of the black nationalist government, they recognized that this was a really good way of approaching wildlife management, in that if you did this ethically and you did it scientifically, you could have a management scheme where wildlife would flourish. The original intent was to empower the communities around the national parks that had been marginalized by the creation of national parks. There were lots of places in Africa where the Africans who had been living and minding their own business and never really affecting the wildlife populations, right? Commercial hunting by whites and other, you know, ivory taking and all that stuff had damaged populations. Those people were the ones who were marginalized. They were moved off of their traditional farming lands, and they were marginalized onto places where they could not be sustainable farmers, and they became the poachers of the world. But a funny thing happened, as I said, and that was that there was a lot of marginal cattle ranching in South Africa, Zimbabwe, in Kenya, in Tanzania, in Zambia, marginal cattle ranching because it was on semi-desert savanna. And they realized that they too came under the same law, and they could get rid of their cattle, get rid of all their internal fencing, and legally, under this new regime, they could put a double electrified 14-foot fence around the whole shooting match by Cape Buffalo, buy kudu, buy impala, and stock them for trophy hunting and make a living off of it. I'll tell you the economics, because there have been peer-reviewed studies of this. Cattle ranching produced 50 cents a year per acre. That is really not a business. Trophy hunting produced $4 an acre. Photo safari business produced $10. Culling of animals for meat produced 50 cents to a dollar an acre. So if you combined all of this into a business model where a little bit of the time you might take a few animals for trophies, an elephant today, what's an elephant worth? $50,000 today? $100,000? I mean, they've gone up since I was working there in the mid-early 2000s. It's a lot of money. And at one conservancy called the Save Valley Conservancy, 960,000 acres, 24 original cattle ranches, 18 owners, some local Zimbabweans and some international rich people combined to form a conservancy. And what happened was actually miraculous. Number one, ecologists told them how long it would take to recover the land. All the big game had been shot out because they didn't want their cattle to have to compete with, you know, kudu and elephants and stuff like that. And a lot of the forest had been cut down to try and produce more grasslands. And so the habitat was very degraded. And ecologists said 30 to 50 years easily before it all recovers. I'll tell you the story in advance. It recovered in 10 years. The lowveld, the savannas are incredible machines of biodiversity, and they have a resilience that nobody suspected. They created this conservancy in the late 80s, and in 92 there was a catastrophe. It was a horrible drought. It was the worst drought they've ever encountered. Animals were dying. The rhinos had almost all been poached out already, and if it hadn't been for the fact that they owned these animals and they had had their own water sources to keep the animals alive and they bought feed, all those animals would have been dead. The death rate in the national parks was 90% of Plains game. It recovers, by the way. It's amazing how it recovers. But it was really rough. At the same time, because of the poaching in the national parks, which the national parks was not able to control, Zimbabwe National Parks gave five conservancies 20 animals each, 20 black rhinos. 20 black rhinos. That is a breeding population of rhinos. You know, three rhinos probably wouldn't do it. Six rhinos might not be enough. 20 rhinos could do it. Let me scroll forward. So that would have been 93, right after the drought. In 94, national parks were going to cull a bunch of elephants. There was a national park that had too many elephants. And if you know about Africa, elephants are like the locust of large animals. They will eat everything. If they run out of their favorite plants, they eat their second favorite plants. If they run out of grass, they will eat the trees. I've seen areas that were totally devastated by overpopulation of elephants. They get overpopulated because no matter how many millions of acres you have, they're still within a fence. And they cannot migrate like they used to 1,000 years ago when they traveled incredible distances. The matriarchs knew exactly where every waterhole was, where every grassland would be, and they moved in very, very large areas. And because of the human populations, it's never going to happen again. They need to be managed. The worst management in the world is the culling of elephants. I've never known a biologist, no less a big game hunter, a professional hunter, who didn't weep with this job. You have to kill an entire herd from the matriarch down to a one-week-old baby. It's a catastrophe. It would rip your heart out. A friend of mine, Clive Stockhill, who, by the way, in 2013 won the first ever Tusk Award created by Prince William, I have really amazing friends there, went to national parks. He had a friend there, Clem Kotze, and said, we can capture entire herds of elephants. Instead of shooting the matriarch so that the rest of the animals will not leave her, we'll dart her. And then we'll dart all the others, except for the littlest babies. We will study them beforehand and make sure who goes with which mom. And we will wrestle them to the ground, and we will put them with their mothers as we transport them. 23 herds, 535 elephants were successfully transported without hurting a single one. Save Valley now had an elephant population that had been totally extirpated during the cattle years. So 2005, I was working on this conservancy as a representative of an American foundation, helping to build capacity between the communal areas that live around them and the conservancy itself. They had to provide a survey every single year to get a hunting quota. And so what they did was their scouts on the ground counted animals, their ranch managers drove on the dirt roads and counted animals, and then they did a professional overflight with biologists counting animals from the air. So all this information was collated. And it's really interesting when you look at this data, because there were 5,000 Cape buffalo. So there's an actual count and then an estimate of population in this database, right? And so there was the actual count, 5,000, and then there was the estimate, 5,000. And then there was 1,425 elephants, and the estimate was 1,500 elephants. And then there was 90 lions, and the estimate was 90 lions. And then there were an estimate of 800 leopards, and you know how many they counted? 8. Leopards are secretive and they're nocturnal, and you cannot go out and count leopards. If you're lucky enough to ever see a leopard in daylight when you're out on safari, that's really a remarkable thing. And so it's pretty amusing. Well, guess what? When they put that game fence around, they didn't have any lions or cheetahs, no less African painted dogs. And it wasn't good for their business to have these predators in there eating their trophy animals, right? But what do you think happened? The cats looked across the fence and said, oh, my God, look at all that cat food over there. How do we get through the fence? The African painted dog got through the fence, and on the 2005 survey, they counted 219 painted dogs out of an estimated population of that time in Africa of 3,000. Now, ask yourself, why did these people who were doing trophy hunting as a business not go out and shoot all the wild dogs? They're fabulous hunters. And the reason is that they were conservationists first and businessmen second. They loved living on this land. Not many people from urban America would go out there and live in these wild places where you're likely to have your electrical outlets torn apart by elephants because some reason they seem to sense the electricity. I watched them do this. They will go and find your underground water pipes and rip them right out of the ground because they like to drink the fresh water. They, you know, and these people love being on the land. And so it was not about making a living. This was a culture of living on the savannas with wildlife. And so we study the wild dogs. I've supported the wild dog researchers. And we've studied the elephant populations and the rhino populations. In 2005, there were 120 black rhinos on the Save Valley Conservancy. In 11 years, the population had gone from 20 to 120. That's a heck of a population replacement rate. Every single rhino was known. Every one of them was looked after by scouts. They were not hunted. They were a national treasure, and yet they were conserved by this 960,000-acre conservancy. The conservancies of Zimbabwe, almost 4 million acres, were the greatest example of private lands conservation in the history of the world. And they have been virtually destroyed by the gangster government of Robert Mugabe and ZANU-PF. And I lived through the whole darn thing. The story to take back to the U.S. here is that market-based incentives for conservation work. And secondly, sustainable livelihoods for people are an important part of the conservation effort. We cannot demonize people. We cannot continue to marginalize people in the third world because we love the animals. Honest to goodness, I was at a benefit in Boulder, Colorado. It's the Socialist Republic of Boulder. And I lecture up there at University of Colorado. I lecture in there at their Environmental Law Society on conflict resolution. And I'm not a lawyer. Anybody a lawyer here? I forgive you. I'm an outsider thinking outside of the box type of processes. So it's not the adversarial process. It's actually a collaborative process of conflict resolution that I'm preaching to law students. I was at this little benefit, and somebody overheard me telling one of these stories, and this woman came up to me, and she said, I don't care about the people. I love the wildlife. And I said, you know what? Those people in Africa that have been marginalized, they're not going to die just before, because you don't care about them. They're going to become the poachers of the world, and they're going to eat the wildlife. There's a negative consequence to a type of advocacy that doesn't see the real world, to see the fact-based, hard world of nature. Nature is not Bambi, right? So this, I know this is a joke, but I like to talk to my audience. What is the most dangerous wild animal in North America? Does anybody know? Yeah. Not, no, we're not wild animals. What's the most dangerous wild animal? Well, sometimes I am, but no, not you. You couldn't be as wild. So what's the most dangerous wild animal? Anybody know? White-tailed deer. More people are killed in automobile accidents. They eat more agricultural products. They carry Lyme's disease, which is a catastrophe in the making. They carry wasting disease. And there's something worse than that. Botanists and forestry experts are discovering that there are so many white-tailed deers from Minnesota all the way to Maine that they are eating every seedling of our forests, and the forest cannot regenerate. And our forests are 250 to 300 years old. You know, we cut a lot of them down, and then we let them regrow, right? And they're reaching old age, and they will not regenerate. The white-tailed deer is a catastrophe. So what's the worst movie ever made for a rational view of conservation?
Bambi.
Bambi. So in my work in Africa, I was able to accomplish a lot of things that were important to me. It was learning from Africans. It was listening to the local communities about what they needed. It was discovering new ways of managing wildlife, unlike what we do in the U.S. It was a great experience. But the fact of the matter is, I've got this outrageous sense of adventure and no fear at all of anything. And so on my first trip to Harare, Zimbabwe, with an American PhD wildlife biologist, I met everybody at World Wildlife Fund working out of Harare, Zimbabwe. And at tea, I went to a meeting that was really boring. I don't like meetings. But at tea, I heard somebody talking about rhinos. It was Raoul de Toit, who runs this conservancy project for International Rhino Foundation, who, by the way, won the Goldman Prize in 2011, which is the Nobel Prize for the Environment, $150,000 award, every penny of which went into the Rhino Project, you know, these kind of people, and received the medal from Barack Obama at the White House. Now, so I really have found amazing people to help to raise money for and to actually volunteer and work with. When I discovered Raoul, I asked him if I could volunteer, and of course he said no. And so I plotted to do that. And the whole story is in the book. I wanted the title of that chapter to be Bombers of Beer, because as a scientist myself, I know that if you throw parties and you get scientists drunk, they might just let you volunteer with them. It worked. It really worked. One of my earliest experiences was on the Save Valley Conservancy, this 960,000 acres in the Southeast Lowveld that I just described to you. I was working on a community outreach project between the community lands outside the conservancy and the conservancy itself. A black rhino calf was seen by scouts to be badly injured by snares. Fences were being taken apart by the invasions that were engendered by ZANU-PF, and the amount of poaching was rising pretty dramatically. These snares were not to catch rhinos. These snares were to catch impala and other small antelope. They're wire snares made out of the fence that used to be electrified before they cut it up. But rhinos would run right through these things, and they would get the snares around them. In fact, I just got an email today that the Sumatran rhino that just was discovered in Borneo, the first one seen in Borneo for many, many decades, died today from an injury caused by a wire snare. So we did field operations. It's pretty disgusting at times, the kind of things that I'll allow myself, you know, to be talked into. And so we called for the rhino team. The helicopter and the spotter plane and the ground crew all showed up. And they invited me to work with them. I had worked with them once before. This was the second time I worked with them, so this would have been about 2004. And we went off driving like maniacs. The helicopter was up in the air with the veterinarian with a big dart gun, and the spotter plane was out talking to the scouts to locate this injured animal. And they darted a cow. At this time, they darted the cow and the calf, which afterwards we discovered that it put the calf at risk because the mother was drunk for hours on the opiate, and she didn't. They're really good mothers. Black rhino mothers are really good mothers, but you don't want to have them both drugged like that. They might wander around, and a one-year-old calf will get eaten by lions. It will not be able to protect itself. It will not survive if it loses track of its mother. And so at this time, they were doing that, and they darted a big old cow, only to discover that it wasn't the one with the calf. And so in we went, out of the vehicles, running like maniacs through the bush with all of this stuff. We carried big old water canisters for pumping, jet washing rhinos. There's a chapter called How to Jet Wash a Rhino. That was one of my jobs. To keep them cool. They overheat and they can die with that opiate inside of them. And so you have a pulse ox, you know, you count the respirations, you have a thermometer up their bum, you do all of this kind of stuff, and you keep them cool by covering them up and keeping them wet, and you're doing that kind of stuff. And that rhino, we did a transmitter. And back then, the transmitters were about that big. And so what they did was, with a chainsaw, they lopped the tip off. We carried chainsaws with us to cut trees down. Rhinos like to fall into trees and go to sleep, and they can strangle. And so you have to actually have a chainsaw, medical supplies, the water bottles. It's just a maniacal operation. And so we ran in there, and we drilled with a router into the side of the horn, and the veterinarian took a long, long drill bit and drilled right down the center of the horn, and the transmitter went in with the antenna sticking out the end of its nose. Right out there, the silliest looking thing. And then they epoxied it into place and covered up with ice, because epoxy actually is a hot reaction, and cool it down, and then cover it and use a color that looks just like the color of rhino horn. We had one for white rhinos and one for black rhinos, because the color of their horns are somewhat different. And so we did that. Then we went back, and the scouts located the mom and the baby. And once again, I wasn't flying in the helicopter at the time, because one of my best college buddies had been killed in a helicopter crash, and I'd sworn to stop doing this stuff. And I did. For 29 years, I didn't fly in a helicopter until I started working in rhino ops, and I finally gave up, and I love flying in helicopters. They are the most fun. So that day, I was still only running into the locations, and we ran off, and we came upon the mother. And I started pumping water on her, and we were taking her temperature, and I was reading the respirations off. And we had the team split up, because they also had the baby sedated. And Natasha Anderson, who was the second in command of Rhino Ops, Natasha, when I met her, was 28 years old, 5'11", blonde Australian, looks better looking than Sigourney Weaver. She is a really good looking lady. You see her picture in there. One of the women I'm kissing, you know, kiss them all. And so I was working with Natasha, and Natasha said, you know, Ed, why don't you go and help Raul with the operation? And I said, well, where are they? And she said, oh, they're right over there, a half a kilometer away through bush with black mambas and large animals like elephants and things that go bump in the night. And you know, and my friend John, who flew the helicopter and also was a veterinarian, said, Ed, right in that direction. And off I went, and I ran around and ran, and here was this baby. It had two snares around its front left leg. One of them had penetrated all the way to the bone. It was an iron snare. The other one was a copper snare from telephone wire, which is very toxic stuff, and it was unbelievably infected. And here I was, and I'm helping with an operation. We did it on a rubber mat right on the veldt. And I'm standing there, I'm sitting, squatting there, and Raul says, scalpel, 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 scalpel. Needle nose pliers, wire cutters. So this is what a bush operation on snare removal is like. They cut them with wire cutters and they pull the snares out. And we removed it successfully. they don't sew up the wounds generally. They let them heal. And then we went after the other one, and it meant digging out screwworm maggots out of the wound with your fingers. And I did it. And I did it. I swore I wasn't going to be a doctor. My family wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer, and I became a geologist. You know, the rocks are a lot cleaner. You know, they don't bleed. You know, and yet here I was in Africa doing this kind of stuff because it was so important. It was so fulfilling. You know, screwworm dust. You know, look in the medical supplies. What on earth is screwworm dust? You know, they only gave shots like a penicillin through the dart hole, so you had to remove the dart. Does anybody here know what they use on rhinos and elephants to sedate them? Do you know what they use? Anybody? It's called M99. It's a terpene. It takes 4 to 6 cc's for a black rhino to be put down with a terpene, probably 10 cc's for an elephant. One drop of a terpene on your skin and you die. And we're working with this stuff, and the darts leak. And I'm washing this stuff off, right? And then the veterinarians come and they pull the darts out if they need to give them shots of penicillin. Now, this is really, and they have a reversal drug, right, for the rhino sticking in its ear. And it turns out that the reversal drug to save a human being's life is a different chemical. And so the veterinarians actually have these things loaded up and ready to go just in case somebody all of a sudden goes and pitches over. You know, with no respiration and no heartbeat. It's really dangerous stuff. A terpene. There's actually a murder case where somebody is suspected to have killed somebody with a terpene, and it doesn't show up in chemical tests. You know, the opiates are really amazing things. So that's what running with rhinos is like. And if anybody wants to do it, I'm sure Raul will say no to you too. It's been an incredible adventure. And one of the things we had to do was stop sedating both mothers and calves, cows and calves. And so they started a new program, which was to make sure that the rhino survived, even if the human beings didn't, which was to dart a calf and then drive off the mother with one of the airplanes, either the spotter plane or the helicopter, and get her far enough away that she could hear her baby and come back, but also far enough away that we could do the work on the ground. So you had to work very, very fast to get everything done. You might measure them, take blood, you know, for disease and parasites, and do veterinary practice on them and do operations, but you had to do it before mom came back. And several times in my experience, mom came back. And so, and I'll tell you one more little story. Not the time that I was almost killed when I was on the back end of a baby rhino, but one day, our regular spotter, Graham Kinnear, Scottish guy of Scottish descent, wonderful biologist, he was the regular spotter. This guy could spot any kind of animal from any, you know, situation. But he was gone that day, and they liked me to fly spotter because I never get airsick. And I'm a desert rat, and this day I was in the airplane for 6 hours nonstop in 115-degree heat. The windows of the Husky, a little tiny, you've seen the pictures of it, a little tiny two-seat airplane, were closed because if you have a window open, your voice-activated microphones made so much noise that you couldn't speak between the pilot and the spotter and the spotters and the scouts and the scouts and the ground crews and the ground crews and the helicopter. I mean, that's a dance going on, right? And so I'm sitting in that spotter seat, and we're working, and we had a place where the ground crew couldn't get in. And the helicopter landed, the pilot's a vet, the veterinarian there, and they were going to work on this baby rhino alone because nobody else could get into the location. It was just too difficult to get a vehicle in. And I'm flying spotter, and we had driven off the mom, and all of a sudden, I'm looking this way, and I'm looking that way, and all of a sudden, the plane went into a dive bombing attack. And we couldn't have been more than 400 feet off the ground when he rolled the plane over. The pilot, Raul, had seen the mother rhino coming back, and she was directly in line with the helicopter because her baby was on the other side of it. She was either going to first smash the helicopter and then kill the veterinarians or, you know, get one or the other of them. And so he went in and dive-bombed this cow, this black rhino cow. And I was with my face smashed up against the plexiglass. This eye was open, so I could actually see, you know, and I watched the ground come up wondering, I wonder how many more seconds you have before you're going to die. You know, there's the ground coming up. And he then went into this incredible climbing turn, right? And as he came up to the apex of the turn, he said, Ed, you doing okay? I said, sure, Raul, but could you tell me the next time you're going to do this? And he said, how about now? And I grabbed onto my five-point harness, and I held on for dear life so that I wasn't plastered against the side of the cockpit. And we did this again and again. We drove her off, and then we drove her off into the countryside. So that's what it's like to play, you know, lunatic saving rhinos. I'd like to open this up for questions, and I think I'm going to...
I will just announce just for our listening audience that a reminder, you're listening to Edward Warner, author, philanthropist, and self-described radical conservationist at a program of the Commonwealth Club of California titled Running with Rhinos. And we'll now welcome audience questions. Again, Karen will take you the microphone.
Thank you. Thank you, Norma.
I have a question on the way to other questions.
A question on the way to the questions.
What's the difference in how endangered between the white and black rhinos, and is the Sumatra rhino different than the others?
There are five species of rhinos around the world. There are three species in Asia and two in Africa. The African species are called the white and the black, and they are not white and black. They're both gray. The story is that wide is Dutch for white, for wide mouth, and it sounded like white to the British, and so they called it that. That very different animals. The black rhino is a browser, has a prehensile lip, and it eats leaves and branches. It's a loner. It lives in thornbush country, and except when they're either mating or when there's a mom and a calf, they live alone. And they're very secretive animals, and they're very easily spooked. If they are feel endangered, they charge and they kill you. They're really, really aggressive animals. The white rhino is a grazer, and it's actually just a giant cow, a three-toed cow, as it were, instead of a two-toed. But it's a large grazing animal. It's a social animal. And so white rhinos are bigger. Black rhino maybe weighs 3,500 pounds max. White rhino bull maybe 6,000 pounds. They're very large animals. But it's not as aggressive. And so if you've seen these slides, you've probably seen a veterinarian holding on to the horn of a white rhino and leading him out in the ocean, or out in the open. And that's because their behavior under the sedative is quite different, which is really interesting. A black rhino, when it's darted, runs and runs and runs and runs and then falls down. Boom, it's asleep. And generally speaking, if they can find the crotch of a tree to strangle themselves on, they will do that. Thus, we're running after them with chainsaws to cut down the tree if we have to cut the brush that they've fallen into if they fall into a thorn bush. But they have this behavior, and they go to sleep just like that. And so if you're running after them when they're sedated and you get there too soon, then they're running after you. And if you run after them and you don't get there soon enough, they might die. And so it's an incredible little dance of timing to get there just at the right time. So these are highly trained people that do this kind of nutsy stuff. The white rhino, when it gets sedated, and you may have seen this, I saw a video just recently, they tend to just slow down and slow down, right? And then they start lifting their leg up like that, and you know that they really are out of it. But they don't fall down. Some of them go to sleep right on their feet. And we have to actually push them down, fold their legs under them. And if they go over on their side, this is 6,000 pounds. How many men do you think, or women, do you think it takes to lift up a white rhino that weighs 6,000 pounds and roll it back up? You don't want to leave it on its side because it can't breathe as well. So you have to prop it back up. So there was Chris Foggins, the retired chief of veterinary medicine in all of Zimbabwe of national parks, and he actually had a hold of that horn. He's just leading that rhino out in the open so he didn't fall down where we couldn't work on him. We didn't want to have to cut the trees down. It's too much work, right? And that rhino was the one you see me. I'm sitting on an oxygen bottle, giving it oxygen. My hand is on its side, not because I love it, which I do, but because I'm actually counting respirations. So white rhinos are less endangered than blacks. They were almost extirpated, but they came back very, very well, and there are like 12,000 of them in South Africa. So they've been recovered pretty well. The black rhino is much more difficult to recover. There's only about 5,000 of them, maybe, in all of sub-Saharan Africa.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the community engagement that you were involved in and the Conservancy was involved in? And then also, it sounds like a lot of your work was in 2005, and I know there's been a lot of changes in Zimbabwe. So if you can just talk a little bit about what's happening now, that would be great. Thank you.
You bet. The community engagement was to make sure that you had the support of the surrounding community supporting the Conservancy. The Conservancy created a lot of wealth for the communities. It created jobs. It created a lot of agricultural products. They would have communities engagement where harvesting of downed wood would be allowed for firewood. We supplied them with a lot of meat. Save Valley Conservancy in 2005, remember I talked about that game count. The game count was 105,000 large animals. 105,000 large animals on just under 1 million acres, including 25,000 impala. National parks allowed them to cull 7,000 impala that year. So what they would do was they had abattoirs on the Conservancy to process meat, and they would go out at night. Professional hunters with torches would find an entire band of male impala. Their non-breeding herd of males, they hang out together, they're juveniles, and shoot them all. Shoot every last one of them through the eye. Boom, 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 kill them all. 30, 40 animals, load them up onto the trucks, haul them away, and they would be butchered and processed before morning. That meat was worth probably 50 cents or a dollar a pound. It went as bonuses to the employees, it fed people like me, and it went to the local communities. It was given to them as payment for protection of the fences and the integrity of the conservation area, and it was also sold to them, so they actually had to pay for some of that meat. 7,000 impalas produce almost 750,000 pounds of meat in a year. You don't shoot the breeding herds, you never shoot elephant breeding herds, the only elephants ever taken are males. Trophy elephants. You never mess with the females. They don't like it. You know, they'll kill you. You know, they talk among themselves. You know, you do not want to mess with the girls. So there was a lot of that. We supported the schools in the communities, not just personally. My wife and I, you know, would smuggle school supplies. She's an artist, so we'd get all kinds of paints and papers and all kinds of stuff for the kids. But no, the Conservancy supported the school system. The Conservancy supported the medical clinics as well. So in the well-run conservancies, they had a really great relationship with the local people living around them. And in fact, when the Mugabe government started the invasions, a lot of those communities actually protected the white farmers from invasions. These were outsiders who were coming in to invade these lands, and they did not want to see this happen. So it was quite an upheaval that happened in some of these areas. Zimbabwe is a gangster government, and until those guys are gone, it'll never recover. For years, I would go back two or three times a year, year after year after year, and my friends would say, there's nothing left to steal, so I learned a really important lesson in life. There's always something left to steal. It's really dreadful. Just about the time they had raped the entire country, the agricultural production had collapsed. If you don't know this, Zimbabwe in 2000 was the fourth largest agricultural exporter in the world. The world, not Africa, the world. And it was destroyed. They can't feed themselves. The first people to object to the land resettlement were the farm workers working on the commercial farms. 50,000 blacks went into the streets. They were the highest paid agricultural workers in Africa. Zimbabwe was not South Africa. It never had apartheid. My white friends' kids were going to school with black kids, and my black friends' kids had white kids for friends. It was a very different culture. If Robert Mugabe and his gangsters had just said, we've done our jobs, we can afford to lose an election, we can elect democracy, you know, flourish in this country, he would have been the second Nelson Mandela. Instead, he couldn't do that. He couldn't give up power. He was a military guy. He was trained to kill people. He was not trained to be a Democrat. and it destroyed that country. And it is not going to recover until those guys are out. You know, just about the time that they had raped and pillaged just about everything in terms of agriculture and lands, they found diamonds. And they just, the army moved in and took the diamonds away from the diamond company, and the army then mined the diamonds. And I can't tell you how many billions of dollars have left Zimbabwe by these gangsters. But I will tell you this much. There was a guy by the name of Majuru who was about fifth down. His wife, Joyce, was actually vice president from the opposition, and he started to go from the dark side to the side of light. He started to see that ZANU-PF, which he was one of, was not doing the right thing, and he was murdered. In a white farm that he had stolen, that he was living in, he was murdered by his own guys. They burned up the whole place to try and cover it up, but he was murdered. A year later, they probated the will. This is not the will from his Panama shell companies or his Cayman Islands bank accounts or his Swiss bank accounts. This was his assets inside of Zimbabwe. This guy was like fifth in the party. How much money do you think he left behind according to his estate? Take a guess, somebody.
$300 million.
$5.7 billion.
Oh.
I almost heaved. I mean, you can't imagine how this affects me. That's a guy, and that's his assets inside the country. So when I talk about the gangsters absolutely raping and pillaging this country, how much went outside, right? How much is overseas? It's unbelievable.
Any other questions?
Yes, I'm going to go back to rhinos. I was on a walking safari in South Africa, and a guide told me something about what to do if you got charged by a rhino. And what he said, if it's a white rhino, they charge in a straight line. You just get behind a bush, and they'll charge right by you. A black rhino can turn on a dime. So the only way you save yourself from them is to climb a tree. Do you agree?
Absolutely. First requirement of rhino ops is they have to prove that you could climb a tree. I was not young then. I mean, I'm older than dirt now. And it's true. White rhinos are not as aggressive, and they tend to run in a straight line. One of the things that we worked on was capturing babies and cataloging them, ear notching them, taking blood, measuring them, doing all that kind of stuff, giving them a catalog number that goes in the book so we knew every single black rhino. But they did not do this with white rhinos very much. And the reason was that, number one, white rhino mothers are stupid. Black rhino mothers are smart. White rhino mothers are really kind of dumb. And so if you went after a 12-month-old white rhino baby, she might forget it ever existed and never find her again, and that would be eaten by lions. And so we didn't want to do that. So we only did work on white rhino babies when they were 2 years old. They were already 2,500 pounds. This is no baby. But they were really these, they slow down, they'd wander around. You were able to stand around them. And I've seen this on video, too, in South Africa, where the veterinarian and the biologist, they're just standing there about 50 feet away, and the white rhino gets up, and it shakes its head, and it wobbles around, and it wanders off. You would never do that with a black rhino. In fact, in 2012, we had 18 babies to process, and we processed number 16, and we couldn't find the last two. You know, this is 750,000 acres, they could be anywhere. And so the scouts are out trying to find the last ones. And so we had nothing else to do, so we processed a bunch of white rhino babies. These big old 2,500-pound dummies, you know. And it had been explained to me that one time they had actually processed a white rhino bull. They had translocated it, and they had let it out of the boma where it had stayed for 2 weeks, and it was so scared it ran in a straight line. In a straight line for 40 miles. So if that had been a cow with a baby, that would have been the end of that baby. It would have been eaten by lions. So you don't want that to happen. Well, we got kind of sloppy because you can stand around and you can just about kick them in the butt when they're waking up. They do it quite slowly and they don't get aggressive, and they might charge a little bit here or there, but they really are not really interested in tangling with you. Well, 2 days later, the scouts located number 17 of the babies, And it was right at the end of a day when we had processed five white rhinos, and we kind of got sloppy. So the black rhino, it was a little male. It was about 600 pounds. It was about 14 months old. And it was darted, and it went to sleep behind a little mopani tree. And we had three veterinarians with us today, a girl who had been an intern, her husband, they were working in South Africa on small animals. So what do on vacation? You go work with rhinos. I mean, that's what's fun for them, right? So we had three veterinarians. We had the conservator of this conservancy. We had all of these people around, including me. And we had processed this rhino. Everybody got back in the vehicle. And the veterinarian went to reverse the rhino and then run away. And two of the veterinarians didn't climb in the vehicle. They were standing behind it. I was up at the roll bar. So I was up above them looking down at them. And I'm looking through my binoculars. And a chap reversed the rhino. And it popped up like a pop-up toy. Just like that, within 5 seconds, it came awake and it popped up, and you could see that it was really angry, and it then charged off in one direction, turned around and came back, and then looked me square in the eye from behind that tree, and I was pounding on the roof of the vehicle. I was screaming to tell them to get started. I was screaming at the vets to get in the vehicle, and that little rhino charged flat out. That's when you discover that a rhino charges and runs just like a horse. It went into gallop, and all 4 feet were off the ground periodically. It was digging. It was digging with its front feet, charging as fast as a car. And they can go 30 miles an hour. The vehicle moved off, and we were not on a road. We were down in the bush, right? And so it was accelerating to get away from the rhino, and we hit a log underneath the grass and stopped dead. And the rhino hit the back of the vehicle, and it popped up in the air, and halfway went into the vehicle, and then Katrina, who was the driver, one of the conservancy wives, actually, got it back in gear, and the rhino bounced in the air, and Norman English put his hand on the side of that rhino's head and pushed him out. And we drove off. We finally got to the road. The rhino ran out of gas. It was a little guy, right? So he ran out of gas pretty fast. And then we finally left. We got out of the vehicle, and when it crashed into the tailgate of the vehicle, it actually hit it twice. And a black rhino does not hit like that. It actually twists its head. This was a 14-month-old baby, and it already had this instinct to eviscerate you. So what it does is it actually twists its horn like that, and there was an X. There were two X's on the back of the vehicle. Yeah. You know what I did? I had my camera. All I had to do is press movie, and I'd have had a YouTube sensation. I was so totally freaked out that I pressed the button of the camera, and I got one smeared picture. Green something and gray rhino smeared across the picture.
I had two questions. There are a couple of photos of a helicopter and a plane crash. I was wondering if you could tell us the short stories behind that. And the other question is how successful, you see this on TV, a lot of shaving, cutting the rhino horns off. How successful is that in saving a population?
Dehorning is a real controversial issue. It's right up there with hunting them, to raise money for conservation. Does it work? Is it the right message? Rhinos need their horns. It's part of their defense system. And also, it grows back. It's hair and it's fingernail. And so it grows back at 4 inches a year. And if you're a poor poacher and you see a rhino with an 8-inch horn, 2 years of growth, you're going to kill it because you're not going to wait around hoping for a bigger one when you know there are guys out there with guns that if they intercept you, they might kill you. So I have great doubts about the dehorning programs being of any value. The airplanes were a very difficult moment in my life. I had taken an oath early in my life not to fly in helicopters, and I started flying in them again. I was also doing research on conservation projects with a friend of mine, Mike Jones. My wife calls him Africa's John Wayne. Mike was in Zimbabwean national parks. He was a ranger, and he stepped on a landmine during the Bush War and blew his leg off and had other physical injuries from that landmine. And he and I, he's a great character, tough, tough bugger. And he and I were arranging to go into a very remote bush area to look at a potential conservation project right up underneath the Angolan border in Zambia. And we had gotten, theoretically at least, an airplane from a mining company, and it would save us a lot of money because that's a very expensive thing to charter an airport and go airplane and go off in the bush, you know, for a week at a time to do these kind of evaluations. And while I was working on Rhino Ops, flying in the helicopter, having broken this oath, Mike came down from Harare and said, I know you have a keynote address at a conference in Snowmass, Colorado. You got to go home. I don't know when the airplane's going to be available to us. If it's months from now, I know you'll come back for it. And if it's a few days from now, I'll just go off and do it without you. So I get back to Colorado, and I go up to Snowmass, and I'm getting ready for this conference. And I fire up my computer the first morning, and there's an email. The helicopter crashed. And it was pilot error. The veterinarian's son had jumped into the passenger seat with a veterinary pack, and the handle had looped over the gizmo that accelerates the helicopter, whatever that thing is called. It's got a... You know the name? Well, no, there's another name. Anyhow, the helicopter stalled because it couldn't accelerate all the way back, and it just rolled over and crashed. The guy's father fell out of it, of course, because he wasn't belted in. The veterinarians, when with their dart guns, the whole side is, you know, empty. They take all the, you know, the doors off, you know, when they do this. He fell out, and the helicopter fell on him. Fortunately, the helicopter is not very heavy, and he didn't die, but he was 6 weeks in hospital getting bolted back together again. So that shocked me, and I felt really horrible. I know this is stupid, but I had broken an oath, and the helicopter crashed a few days later. What is that about? And I know I'm a scientist. I know that it has nothing to do with me or anything that I might think, right? It's an absolute coincidence, but it really upset me. The next morning, I go back, and I'm firing up my computer, and my cell phone rings, and it's the president of the Sand County Foundation, Brent Hagland, letting me know that Mike had gone off in the airplane, and it had crashed in Zambia on this dirt strip, and that the guy sitting next to where I would have been sitting was dead. And Mike was, I'm not making this up, this sounds like a movie script, was being attended by nuns from the nearest mission on the dirt airstrip, and there was no medevac service. And so I had a number of names, and we called them, and one of them, Erst Kreuter of Texas A&M, who is a Zimbabwean originally and has a lot of family back there, it turns out his brother flew medevac out of Johannesburg. An hour later, they were in the air. They got my friend Mike out. They took him to Lusaka. They looked at him and said, we can't do anything. They took him to Johannesburg, and they saved him on the operating table.
I will
I was supposed to be on that airplane. And if you look at the where that's crushed, the big hole in the back, that was where my seat would have been.
I will take the privilege of the last question due to time constraints. So I have not yet read all of your book, but I've read some, and I recall a reference to piri piri chicken livers made with African bird's eye chili peppers, as I recall. Could you tell us about those?
Yeah, you know piri piri, right? Rachel works in Africa. Oh, look at that face. I love this stuff. It's as hot as jalapenos. It's hot as the stuff I eat in Indonesia. You know, it's really, really hot sauce. And so piri piri means, like, what, hotter than all get out chicken. Well, thank you very much.
On behalf of the Commonwealth Club, we wish to thank Dr. Edward Warner, author, philanthropist, and self-described radical conservationist, our author of Running with Rhinos. And now this program of the Commonwealth Club in its 113th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.